In Rockland County, New York, there's a village called New Square. The people who live there don't mix much with the world outside their village borders. They're the Squarers, one of the most insular sects of Hasidic Jews in the U.S. So insular that if you grow up a Squarer, you can spend your entire life inside the village. Shulam Dean wasn't born there, but he moved to New Square when he was about 13. He married a girl from the community. They had 5 children. And then he got curious about the world outside those village limits.
At the entrance to the village, there's a yellow sign with Village Law Number 3, which prohibits entry into the village if you're wearing immodest clothing, shorts or sleeveless clothes or a list of things. And it's an actual law on the books of the village.
And so in daily life, of course, no television, no radio.
Oh, of course not.
No computers?
No newspapers. Computers, they consider computers a very, very, quote, terrible danger.
So this is the community you chose to live in. You weren't born into it. So there were things about it that appealed, at least,
right?
At least initially. And you also, as a young man, like as a yeshiva student, you kind of joined in trying to help police other students' behavior.
Yeah, absolutely. What happened was that we were sort of the elite group within our sort of like our cohort, our age group. There was an elite group within that I was part of, and we would gather at dawn to study mystical texts. And it was this one Friday morning when our leader got worked up into a really sort of passionate screed about rumors he'd been hearing about students who were watching television and reading newspapers and reading secular news magazines and listening to secular music, and that this is destroying our souls and it's destroying everything that our old Rebbe had worked to preserve within this shtetl. And it was basically a call to action. And we said, well, what do we do? He said, do something, anything. And so we got together and we drew up a list and we summoned some of our peers and we sat them down and we told them that in no uncertain terms that they will be beaten physically if we ever caught them doing any of these things.
And do you think any of them had actually been doing that?
I think some might have. Yeah, it's possible. And then one of the students we summoned didn't show, and so we went to the dorm, broke open the door, and then just ripped apart everything in his room. We sort of, you know, overturned his dresser, ripped the linen off the mattresses, overturned the mattresses to see if we can find something. And that was a terrible, terrible, terribly shameful episode for me for many, many years after. It didn't take long for me to realize that what we did was wrong.
Well, and fast forward a bunch of years and, you know, in your mid-20s, and mm-hmm. you got curious about the outside world and you became what you were afraid of back as a yeshiva student. You became somebody who was sneaking and listening to the radio and reading
yes.
forbidden books.
Right.
How did that even start?
You know, it started with really small things that didn't feel like much. And there's one episode that actually is really meaningful. My friend, I had a friend, I call him Chesky. He was what we called an alte bacher, which is Yiddish for an old bachelor. He was 22. And so he came to me once and said that he's been listening to the radio. He started listening to the radio before I did. And he said they were playing this baseball game. The New York Yankees were playing the Arizona Diamondbacks in Game 7 of the World Series. And apparently the people on the radio were saying that this is a really big deal. And so he and I were sort of curious, what is this, a baseball game? And I knew there were bars, but I didn't quite know what bars were for, but I knew that some bars had televisions in them. But it felt really strange. We were like, you know, two Hasidic men walking into a bar. It felt like that could be, you know, that, without knowing that that could be the start of a joke, that sort of felt kind of weird and strange. In the end, we found a sort of little local hotel, and we saw the bluish lights flickering through the curtains of the lobby. And so, I mean, this was probably the first time in her life that the receptionist had two Hasidic men come in and ask permission to watch TV in her lobby. But she had no objections. And we sat there, and, you know, by the end of 3 hours, one team won, I forget which, we didn't know why. I mean, frankly, it was really baffling.
But you did then after that, you know, it's like a slippery slope, right? Because you did then begin reading books that I'm sure
yes.
nobody in your community would have wanted you to read. And you,
right.
know, you listened to radio shows and you went to Blockbuster Video.
Right, right. And so these were all small steps that I took to sort of open, to create a little world of freedom for myself, although it wasn't really a world of freedom. It was a world of intense secrecy. My wife, who I call Gitti in the book, Gitti knew about some of the things I was doing. And she was not happy about it, and we had a lot of tension about it. But she tried. She tried to go along with this crazy husband of hers who was just not content to be a regular chassid like everyone else.
Well, so you were trying to live with that tension, you know, compartmentalizing or whatever you were doing. But you actually wound up, in the end, getting kicked out. I mean, the elders
right.
suspected something. They called you in, rejected you, branded you as a heretic?
Yep. Yeah, that's what they called me, a heretic, a sinner who causes others to sin. And yeah, they kicked me out. They expelled me, which was, you know, not just, it's not that they revoked my synagogue membership. They ordered me to sell my house, pack up my things, and move.
What did your wife say?
You had five children.
Five children,
by this time.
Yeah, yeah. So it was very difficult because she would be allowed to stay. She was not ordered to leave.
Mm-hmm.
I was ordered to leave. So she could either come along with me or she could stay and we would split. In the end, it just couldn't work. We had grown too far apart religiously and I couldn't stay in a world that I didn't want to live. And I couldn't stay in a world where I was hiding who I really was. And I was lying about myself every day, lying to my wife plenty, lying to my kids, lying to my friends, to the community. And that takes a real psychic toll. It can drag you down into such a really dark place.
Well, unfortunately, it got darker. The pressure on her and the children to stay away from you was kind of overwhelming. And in the
right.
end, you wound up losing your kids, too.
Right, right. Once we were split, they really did not want me to have much to do with the children. And they were really indoctrinating the children with things about me. One of my sons at some point told me that, you know, mommy says you want to turn us into goyim.
Hmm.
She started to see me as just this evil, wicked person. And that came off onto the children. And the children started to withdraw. And that was a really, really dark place.
I can't imagine having your own children turn against you to the point that even though you had a legal right to continue to see them,
yeah,
they just didn't want to see you.
Yeah. Yeah.
How long has it been since you've seen them?
Well, it's been 8 years since they were in my life. You know, each one was different. My oldest daughter I haven't seen in 8 years, and that was 7 years because I'd seen her briefly. A judge had ordered her to come, and so she would come, but she wouldn't say a word, and that just lasted a few weeks. My second daughter I saw by chance a couple years ago. I had come up to New Square for something or other, and I saw her and I stopped and I sort of waved to her and she recognized me and she came into the car and we had a conversation. It was clearly very difficult for her and she wasn't sure if she was allowed to get into the car or not. But then I gave her my phone number and my address and hoped that she might call, but she didn't.
Are you angry that they don't want to see you?
You know, I am. I am to some degree. I am angry at the indoctrination. It is clear to me that they've been indoctrinated with ideas about who I am. And, you know, but the question is, to what degree can I expect or can I ask for them to reject what they've been taught when they are still living within a community that expects a very, very high level of conformity and uniformity of thought? It would have consequences for them if they chose to reject what they've been taught and to reach out to me. So they're complicated feelings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe because, you know, we're talking about this in the context of thinking about renunciation, but it seems to me the most terrible, kind of painful thing about this story is the way religion has been used to separate people from one another. Most of the world's religions teach love, primarily. But there's something about this concept of the path to virtue being a path of renunciation, of giving things up, that seems like it leads to not such a good place. And yet every religion has that path.
Yeah, I mean, you know, religions have the potential for something incredibly good and incredibly damaging. I mean, I tend to see religion as another form of ideology, but just something that is grounded in truth claims that demand so much of you, and can move you to do incredible acts of kindness and incredible acts of humanity. But it can also move people to do really, really terrible, damaging, and hurtful things. When someone is considered evil within a religious context, and the religion is what informs your life in every way, and maybe mostly in good ways, but if someone is declared by your religion to be evil, it is very hard to renounce that.
Shulam Dean. His memoir is called All Who Go Do Not Return.